You are at the intersection of wealth, health, and happiness. Welcome to the Wealthy, Wealthy Life. Welcome to Wealthy, Wealthy Life. I'm so excited to introduce you to Evan Baer. Evan is the co-founder of Able Lending. And Evan is one smart dude, man. He went to Princeton for undergrad, Yale for law school, and Harvard Business for entrepreneurship. And he worked underneath the likes of Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook and Peter Thiel of PayPal. You're going to get so many golden nuggets out of this conversation. We really delve into technology and entrepreneurship and disruption. And then we really dive into the topic of money and money in the context of capital, raising capital, different types of capital, how to get access to capital as a startup entrepreneur. When this is your first venture, how do you get money when you don't, you know, you haven't built sort of the trust out there in the marketplace yet where people want to hand money to you? So be sure to listen. You're going to learn a lot, especially if you're in the entrepreneurship business world, but everyone will take so much from this interview just because Evan is such a smart, awesome, passionate, inspirational guy that loves to share his love of learning and his own experiences. Anyway, enjoy. All right, Evan. So it's so fun being here in this fun warehouse space in downtown Austin.
Thank you. Yeah, really great to have you here and welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you. So you're a pretty fascinating guy. I've done a little research and Princeton, Harvard, Yale.
Let's be clear. People that say that are either my mother or people that don't know that many people. So let's keep the compliments low.
All right.
Yeah, well, no, I've had a strange past and have sort of gone down certain roads and then said, no, that's not quite the right thing, and then back it up and change course. And anyway, but it's been a fun journey.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your journey. Just sum it up very quickly. You're in Austin, Texas. And what brought you here? You've got an interesting background where you started and then somehow you wound up here. So fill in a few little gaps.
Yeah. So quick version on getting to Austin. So originally way back, born and raised in Pensacola, Florida, the Redneck Riviera, home of the Throat Mullet. We can come back to that later if that's interesting to you. Then lived in the Northeast for basically about 15 years. Wherever the Acela train stopped, we lived there. So DC, Philly, New Haven, New York, Boston, I think that's about it. And then we did a short stint in California. So how did we get to Austin? So a good friend of mine at business school was from Texas. And at the end of business school, my wife and I were about to move back to California where we'd lived before. And it's like at the last minute. And my buddy says we should start a company. And we ran after that for a few months and decided to start it. And he was from Texas and it was a whirlwind decision, but essentially there were some push factors from California, like things that made life really hard in California that we were fine to be pushed by. And there were some great pull factors to come to Austin, that it was just a wonderful place already and heading in a great direction. So it was a frenzied decision, but one we were comfortable with at the time, my wife and I, and one we certainly are glad we made now.
Awesome. And so you made your way to Austin, and you're a man after my own heart because it looks like you've got this little bit of this disruptive nature to you. It must be in your blood. Sounds like you turned down Facebook. You've turned down a few things to get into this startup game, being this entrepreneur, but not any entrepreneur. It looks like you've tackled mail, the big mail system. And by the way, with Outbox, I was probably one of your first customers. I loved Outbox.
Oh,
loved it. Whenever, when it went away, I'm like, you're killing me. What do I do now with all this freaking junk mail?
But I love meeting former customers or people who, you know, share the lament. It's kind of a compliment, but it's also very sad because mm-hmm. it's like we hear things, you know, it was so good. And I'm just like, man, and some good friends, we sort of say like, it was maybe an idea before its time. I mean, there's still, someone needs to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. We can get more into it if you're interested in it, but the Postal Service actually has launched their own digital version, which is like totally insane and terrible and everyone hates it. So it is an idea that will come around one day. But yeah, we love tackling these kind of masochistic problems that are messy and complicated.
Well, where I'm curious though is you started Outbox, you founded Outbox. Great concept. Like I said, as a customer of yours, I loved it. It solved a real problem, and I was really sad when it went away. But then how the pivot from mail to fintech to business loans, they don't seem very related. How did that come to be? Like what was the spark behind fintech, business loans, and this whole ABLE?
Yeah.
What's behind ABLE as a concept?
Yeah, well, you are right to be curious. You could also say totally confused because it makes no sense to the outside world. So I'll share sort of the mechanics of the pivot, but backing up just a little bit, you know, there's some lines in Peter Thiel's book, Zero to One, which if the listeners haven't read it, it's a fabulous book. Every page is worth reading multiple times and really dwelling on. But Peter Thiel, author of the book, has an interesting story in that he ran after a pretty conventional path. He went to Stanford undergrad, Stanford law school, clerked on the 11th Circuit, and then had lived this very tracked life to become a lawyer because he thought that being a lawyer was how you change the world. And so his very last application was to clerk on the Supreme Court. And he had always won everything he'd ever done, always been told yes, and he applies to the clerkship, interviews, and then he doesn't get it. And that was the first moment of defeat he'd ever had. And it shattered his whole image of himself as this person that was going to change the world through law. So he picks up the phone and he calls one of his friends from undergrad, Max Levchin. And Max is talking about some startup thing he's working on. Peter's like, huh, that sounds kind of interesting. Okay, like, let's go work on this. And that was PayPal.
Wow.
So Peter then reflects on that story, but then has some really just vicious and sound but merciless advice, I think, for my former self, but even for me on many days. And he has there's two things I'll share quickly. So one is he has this contrast between what he calls a definite optimist and an indefinite optimist. And so the indefinite optimist says, I believe the future is going to get better, but I'm not really sure how. So I'm just going to go hang around people that are going to make it better, and I will make money by being around them. The definite optimist is someone who says, I know the world is going to be better, and precisely because of what I go try to do, it will be better. And so Peter's general lament is that many people, especially millennials, children of boomers, we are massively afflicted with indefinite optimism. Mm. And so we try to do all these things to keep our doors open. And we rack up all these accomplishments to keep having all this competition to be, he says, wonderfully prepared for what you aren't exactly sure, which is just so damning. And then the second line he has, which I just love, it's just terrifying. He says, all Rhodes scholars had a great future in their past.
Oh, wow.
And to me, it is just this devastating line about how we as people pursue meaning and success. And I was totally that person who was the indefinite optimist. I didn't really have ideas of my own that I was working on. I wanted to rack up accomplishments because it felt like it was yet another credential that would help me do something eventually. What that thing was, I had no idea. And so my case was not applying to the Supreme Court. It was actually meeting Peter and having a dinner with Peter and then working with him for several years and soaking a lot of that learning up. So that was way longer than you wanted. But that just is, for me, an interesting thing to talk about because it gets to the kinds of companies that Will, my co-founder, who shares many of these similar thoughts, we like to build. So when we were working on Outbox, that was easily one of these in those categories of definite optimism that we were going to build a company that had a chance to change how the government delivered a really bad service. And the story of that, many people know, and we can talk more about later if interesting. So the fast forward to the pivot, we had this strange situation where we had launched the Outbox service to the public in San Francisco about 3 months after an equity raise for that business. And we were watching the data very closely. And the two things we really had to learn were how much would it cost to acquire a customer? And then how much money would we make on every customer? So kind of the two fundamentals, the acquisition cost and then what we call the lifetime value of the customer. And so After that launch in San Francisco, it was a chance to collect a lot of data very quickly. And that data came in, as it does for many startups, pretty discouraging. And the business model equation for us was actually led us to conclude that the numbers were such that for us to actually prove out the model, we would have to operate at losses for tens of millions of dollars. Mm. So it was sort of like to make the business model work after the Postal Service had shut down how we worked with them, it was going to take probably $50 million. And we reached this conclusion that we can't do it. Some combination of like, we shouldn't do it, we can't do it, it's not wise to do it. And we went to our board and then eventually the rest of the investors to say, here's what we think. We want to be respectful of your money. We're willing to give it back. And then we heard time and time again, something along the lines of, you built an amazing team. You moved really quickly. You got data back and answers back to really difficult questions. So exactly the right thing to do right now is use that awesome team you have and the resources you have to go do something else. Mm-hmm. Okay. So 47 minutes into my answer to your question of the pivot, you still want to talk about the pivot? We can move and talk about something else. Do you want to hear the early days of Able or do you want to go somewhere else?
I've been known to be a disruptor in the real estate industry.
Yeah.
I own a mortgage company and a real estate company and have been in the sort of the finance world, real estate world. So a little background there, different than Able, of course.
Right.
But then I own several small businesses. Mm. I'm a small business startup person.
Yeah.
And I've been in, you know, that initial capital is always sometimes it's scary. Like, how do I find the capital, get this up and going?
Yeah. And yours friends and family, or can you talk about yours a little bit? I'm so curious.
Mine was more just bootstrapping it.
Yeah.
So every business I've started, and several have been fairly successful, has been bootstrapped. Wow. But it's really hard, that place of making decisions where you're barely getting by and you know you need to hire the next person, but you don't. And it's sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul some months to, you know, even so you see cash flow. And so I know what that feels like, being in startup, a small business, and having access to money, especially before you really, it's easy to get money once you've sort of, you know, proven yourself, but the initial stages is difficult. So anyway, my point is I'm very interested in the idea behind this, like where it's disrupting kind of this banking side of things, being really moving into this out of the mail side of things, into the fintech world, which is a whole different category. So anyway, personally, it has a lot of interest to me. And two, it's just the curiosity of the leap and then how the spark behind Able.
Yeah. Well, first of all,
disrupting this whole new business model industry.
Well, I want to say first, people like you who build real businesses and multiple small businesses, I mean, I really believe are the heroes of this country. And congratulations on doing that. That is in many ways way harder than tricking a bunch of venture capitalists to just write you a check and then you go play around with the money. That's not how we think about what we do, but to just sort of stereotype, you know, it's really two different kinds of businesses. And so the founding pathway to get to Able was sparked by a bunch of different points of inspiration. I had a background in financial services, working at a hedge fund, and thought a lot about capital markets. Will, my co-founder from Outbox, had worked on the House Financial Services Committee in U.S. federal government and Congress, and had actually written a bunch of legislation that changed how banks operate. So I will say there's kind of two points of inspiration that came together. Number one, because we live in Austin, and this is a really cool kind of, you know, providential moment to how Able got started. It was that only because we live in Austin are we in regular community with real people that own small businesses. That's not the experience that most people have when you live in New York or San Francisco. Even if you're hanging out with a lot of founders that live in San Francisco, they all make apps or software companies. You don't know, literally, I mean, it's Adam Smith style, the baker, the butcher. I mean, we literally know bakers and butchers in Austin. And that's such a wonderful component of a rich community life in Austin. So one data point there was we just got to know a lot of small business owners, and we're always talking about how do you raise money and access capital, because just we had raised money. And what kept coming up over and over again was how hard it was for them to raise money. Mm-hmm. Even brands that have awesome experiences and locations in Austin, that for the outsider, you'd think, of course they're fundable. They must have equity investors, or of course banks must be falling all over themselves to fund them. It was not the reality at all. So that was one really interesting piece of inspiration. And the second piece was that we used to work in Washington, D.C., and we think a lot about U.S. federal government policy and ways that it really messes up or challenges healthy functioning markets of all kinds. And so what we were watching on the federal front was what happens after any kind of economic disruption is the feds get nervous and they come in and they tighten a lot of regulations in order to respond to voter demands. Mm-hmm. And usually that results in chaos in the markets mm-hmm. and all sorts of inefficiencies. And it has here as well. So since 2008, large bank lending to small businesses is off 42%. And that has been partly filled in by alternative lenders who operate at insanely high interest rates. So when we put those kind of two things together, number one, we realized that some of the nation's best small businesses were not able to get capital. Mm-hmm. And that's a marked change to even within the last 8 or certainly 10 years, when they were able to access $500,000, $1 million low interest term loans from banks. Banks literally are not just choosing to be mean. Bankers are smart people. Bank CEOs are smart people. In many cases, the federal government literally will not let them make the loan. So that was really shocking to us.
Interesting, right?
So the challenge that we had, the riddle we were trying to solve was, it seems that there's about 500,000 small businesses created every year. Generally, banks aren't funding businesses until they're like 3 or 4 years old mm-hmm. and maybe $1 million in revenue. So from our perspective, that means there's about a base of 2 million or more small businesses in the United States that can't access any kind of capital. So the impacts of that are just massive. Significantly fewer jobs are created. Mm-hmm. Significantly less wealth is created. Local restaurants or apparel shops aren't created, which create awesome experiences for, you know, local residents. There's just manifold, huge, terrible impacts when that's our situation for our capital markets. So the situation we were trying to solve was, how do we help find, you know, initially 100, then 1,000, then 10,000 of the nation's best small businesses and get them access to a lot of money at a low rate? And that was the problem to solve. Turns out it's a really hard problem to solve. And really smart people have been working on this problem for a long time and honestly haven't really come up with solutions. So one solution that's in the market today is the mostly online driven merchant cash advance or receivables finance. There's a few different names for the product, but the big ones are Square Capital or OnDeck Capital. Those companies, so Square of the little Square Reader, everyone thinks it's a hip, awesome company inventing the future of finance. So Square loans seem really easy to do. And many customers are like, wow, it looks cool. It must be a good deal. It says like rates starting at 5% and they hit yes on their Square terminal. It's a little more complicated than that, but basically it's super easy. Turns out their average rate is in the high 30% interest rate.
Holy cow.
Which for the record is usurious in mm-hmm. all 48 states that have usury laws. So we are just really sad. I mean, we're shocked initially, but then sad that the innovation that has come to fill this market and help serve small businesses has created a product that for the majority of those small businesses is really dangerous. So in our company, we fund a bunch of small businesses with low interest term loans. Our average, our rates start at 6%. Our average rate is just above 10% right now as an interest rate. On the annual percentage rate, it's about 12%. So we have borrowers that we love funding and are having great businesses. And they'll mention, this has happened multiple times, they mentioned in passing, oh, well, needed a little extra cash to help with this growth cycle, so we did this other deal. And we're like, well, you know, can we learn more about that? We're just so curious how we can, you know, help serve you better. And then we kind of go in and underwrite the deal to just see like, what are the actual terms of it? And so we ask like, well, you know, what do you think the terms are of this deal? Well, you know, it's $25,000. Our plan was to do it just for a few months. And it's really easy because it's daily withdrawals. And you know, I think it was kind of like probably high single digits. And we're like, oh, okay, cool. So you sort of look at this. And so the first one of these that we like re-underwrote came back and the rate was 4,100%.
Oh, come on.
Was the interest rate, which I don't even know mathematically how that works. But a lot of these that we have underwritten are 50, 60% interest rate. And these are not stupid people that are taking this out. These are smart people. These are not even people in desperation. So that makes me really sad that much of the innovation that's capturing a lot of the market has a very dangerous product. So mm-hmm. our product, this riddle we were trying to solve, we went to a really strange place to try to solve this. So my wife for years lived in Eastern Africa and rode around on Boda Bodas, these little motorcycles, going out to visit borrowers, these small business, you know, micro businesses. And what my wife was involved in was helping them get, you know, $10 equivalent loans for a grain mill or something. And so microfinance has been something I've been casually familiar with for 15 years. And the core principle to microfinance, which Muhammad Yunus in building the Grameen Bank later won the Nobel Prize for, it, incredible concept, built a profitable multi-billion dollar business on lending to people that everyone said were unlendable, were not worthy of credit. And I love the Latin for credit, credere, means to believe. So it's just this wonderful concept of like, there's this poor farmer who wants a grain mill to work. And the question is like, do you believe in that person? And for a really long time, the answer was no, we don't believe in that person. They do not get credit. We do not have belief in them. So the concept in microfinance really is, when you know the people that are lending to you and when you lend in community, you are more likely to repay and the credit works. So that was the basic concept, was like, gosh, in this weird way, everything we do online is in community. I mean, with apps these days, I mean, you're doing things like paying your Amex bill in community, for heaven's sakes. I mean, so community is everywhere, except in lending. And there's a few other ones too. But in lending, it's this massive box of anonymity. So you can go online and get a $1 million loan, never see a face of another single person. Your spouse may not even know you took out the loan. It's like porn. It's like this crazy black box around it that like no one knows what's happening. So that was this weird riddle to us. So the way we worked to innovate around that was to say, how can we build a product that brings back the millennia old concept that you lend in community, but do it where we're not in huts in East Africa, but we're doing it, you know, with modern people with iPhones and that use the internet building companies in the US.
Well, and I love that. And really, it should be that easy. It's, I mean, I to be complicated, to be as complicated as it is. And to your point, I love the credit means to believe, and to believe in a community and the farmer or the small business person, whoever that is. It's believing in the community. But so love this. Well, let me ask you this: if I'm a small business, and what are the criteria to, let's say, work with Able, or like, what do you look at? What would I do if I'm thinking of a startup, or I just need that access to capital to meet that next phase to keep things moving forward? Where do I get started?
Yeah. Well, one thing I'll put out is we have a superb underwriting team, and our team ends up working with a lot of people who don't borrow from us. And so those could be, you know, scaling businesses with over $1 million in revenue. In some cases, they can qualify for SBA loans, and we have bankers that we love to connect them with. We also see companies that are maybe pre-revenue, for whom raising equity capital, selling equity in their business, makes more sense. And we've personally raised a lot of money on AngelList and from equity investors. So that's just an offer. Even if our core products aren't a fit, you know, for now, we love to just take time and get to learn people's businesses and be helpful however we can. So I'm Evan@ablelending.com, or they can visit the website. Would personally be happy to talk to anyone about how they can get funded. So our products were built for basically any small business that's not planning to raise equity capital out of the gate. So said in another way, we aren't really designed for venture backable high growth startups, although our products can be used for them. Our products are designed to be flexible enough to really fund businesses pre-revenue up through $1 million or $2 million in revenue. So our loan product is a pretty simple instrument. It's a term loan up to $500,000 that's repayable up to over 5 years. And the payments are processed monthly, and we make it really straightforward and simple. So in that sense, it's a very commodity product. The novelty in what we built as a way to help more people get access to capital is this notion of the people we call a backer. So let's say that you come to us and last year you did $100,000 in revenue and you make beautiful scarves that you sell on Etsy and you did 100K in revenue. Well, most likely you have a credit card that you pay mid to high teens on, You may have a merchant cash advance loan to help with inventory, which you probably pay at least 30, maybe 60% interest rate on. At that rate, you're nearly certainly not bankable, meaning like banks won't extend you credit lines or term loans. And you could possibly sell equity, but for businesses that aren't going to have huge multiples, it's unlikely that you'll sell equity. So to be honest, you don't really have a lot of other options besides your high interest credit card or MCA product. So let's say you did 100K in revenue last year, you'd come to us. We could underwrite you, and we're able to do that when you connect your personal information and your business information through QuickBooks, through our application, which takes about 3 or 4 minutes. Once you do that, that gives our underwriting team enough information about you to be able to say, all right, you'd like $100,000 over a 3-year term based on everything we know about your business. We can do that for, and then we would name an interest rate. So let's say, let's say you're someone and that interest rate should be 16%. Now, to a little context, everyone's credit model is basically the same. So if you come to us or you come to other lenders, we all basically use the same data to calculate the risk-adjusted required rate to charge you on a term loan. So our rates are going to be about the same if we offered the same product. But here's where it gets interesting. So let's say we can give you $100,000 for 16%. What we let you do is if you can go out and raise capital from friends or family, could be customers, other entrepreneurs that you know, every amount of money you raise from them to be lenders alongside Able let you significantly lower the interest rate on your loan. So that could look like this. So let's say it would be 16% as the regular loan, but what we'd let you do is go raise, let's say you raise $20,000 from a uncle, a customer, and a friend who's an entrepreneur. That would certainly bring your interest rate down. That could bring your interest rate down to 10%. And the way we think about it is, two things. Number one, we want to fund businesses that have the people that know them the best. The people that know them the best are willing to back and believe in their business. Mm-hmm. So at the very least, that means we don't like to fund jerks. Okay. You got to like have people that believe in you. The second thing that's really interesting for us is once we fund your loan, we really like the idea that there are several people in your community that are meaningfully part of your business. And we've seen that play out in really cool ways. One example is one of our borrowers has a hair salon, and one of her backers was a longtime customer of hers. And he happened to be a very smart, savvy businessman. And the hairstylist, the salon owner, now has this interesting, smart businessman as someone who cares about her business. Mm-hmm. So they had basically 6 years of cutting his hair where they talked about each other's family. And since he became part of her business, they talk about her business every time. Because we've been entrepreneurs ourselves. We know that it is such a lonely place. Mm-hmm. You have so many questions and it's so overwhelming that it's really important for people to be in your court. So essentially, we would love anyone, if you're pre-revenue, we have a product that lets you use our platform to raise debt capital. And if you are generating revenue, what we can do is based on your performance this last year, we can say, hey, we can fund you this amount of money at this rate. And then if you choose, and we really encourage you to do this, to go get backer support in your loan, then that means you can get a significantly lower interest rate, which we can guarantee is lower than anyone else could get you capital.
That is brilliant. The whole community aspect is really brilliant. And thanks. You're right on. Yeah. That it's like, let us lend you money, but alongside not just you, let me lend the community money.
Yeah.
And everybody that believes in you.
Right.
I mean, I have chill bumps. That's just the coolest concept, really.
Well, there are some crazy things in it. You know, we heard when we went to the equity markets for ourselves and tried to raise capital for this, we heard some horror stories. So Lending Club, which was supposed to be the big first play into social finance, was the idea that retail investors should be able to access, you know, commercial and consumer debt. And wouldn't it be great if people that needed to borrow money had a bigger pool to access capital? Well, we heard two crazy stories. This was fairly common. Number one, when you put together borrowers and lenders online, two things happen. So number one, African Americans received 2 to 3 times the interest rate as Caucasian women. And so one thing we learned is that when you let people make choices filled with all sorts of terrible thinking. Number two was when you put together borrowers and lenders that don't know each other online, they meet online. When the loan doesn't perform, which is common, that's the kind of baked into what happens with a loan. There were cases where the lender like found the business information and like chased down and threatened the borrower.
Oh, wow.
So the early forays into how do we do borrowing and lending among people that know each other, when that's been tried in the United States, it's gone really poorly. So there are real risks, and we're still hoping to be able to prove it out.
So is that sort of differentiating you through the traditional crowdfunding?
We are cheerleaders for crowdfunding. I mean, we have raised equity capital on AngelList itself, and we love the Jobs Act has provisions and will facilitate more ways that people can access capital. Our current hypothesis is that, so to put it in perspective, we have gone out and our plan is to fund $100 million in loans this year from capital that we've organized. And so the insight there was that crowdfunding is a really important way to bring more capital to the market to help fund more small business owners. And also, it's pretty early days. So the reality is most crowdfunding attempts fail. The ones that make it don't raise a lot of money. And so I hope that it grows, but for now, it hasn't really grown. So in our model, we like to have people from the crowd that you know come in and support your loan in a small way, but then we're putting in a lot of our own money on top of that.
Right.
There is an efficiency to, like, if I need to fund you $1 million and I have that organized from a hedge fund or securitized somehow, it's much more efficient if I meet one person and I'm like, you have a great business and I just give you $1 million versus organizing, you know, 1,000 people at $1,000 a person. The transaction costs are massive. So we're in that sense kind of a hybrid where we have a component of what we do is based on people that know you, but then a big part of what we do is sort of big boy funding, like a bank or a hedge fund would operate.
I see. And then it sounds like, if I hear you right, it's really designed for the small business owners that they're local, they're in their community, they're not trying to maybe have the big exit and, you know, the sort of the craziness. It's like, no, I'm just right here in my community, I'm building this business, I need some help to get started or to bridge the gap between where I am and the place I need to be. And it's like this homegrown idea, and that I can come to you to say, hey, I need some help and I've got some friends and some backers behind me, and we make this a good deal for both, and it's just the uplift.
You said it perfectly. We know that what we're doing is crazy. And we know that when we ask a small business owner to come be funded through Able, that we're kind of asking something weird. We are asking you to do something that is strange. It's a different way of doing things. So the kinds of business owners we're seeking out are people that want to be part of trying to build a new way that small businesses grow. So we don't formally say this, but like, if you have a little sprinkle of crazy in you, if you want to participate in something different, you know, you're signing up for something that is, in certain ways, it's a bit of an experiment. Now, the good news for you is that it is an experiment. Experiments can fail, but you get all the money up front. So if we fail, like, you still have the money. So it's not risky in that sense, because you do get funded. And on average, our borrowers save about $31,000 relative to the other loan that they were going to get, as just a round number. So we know that our deal is good for our customers. And we like people that want to co-create with us this new way that small businesses get funded and grow.
Well, I love it. So let's get into sort of the end of our time here together. I've found myself as being an entrepreneur, somewhat of an innovator, known as a disruptor in the real estate industry, and now in the personal finance money side of things. Is there are a lot of myths out there that people hold as true, and that they're just flat out wrong, that are causing people, and maybe some, they might have been even true at one time, maybe more the industrial age, but now we're in this new digital space. You're making big disruption, or hope to, in this space. So is there a myth like that you can think of in this fintech side of things, or this, you know, what you're trying to do, where most people, your customers, or just more consumers, are sort of trapped in this old way of thinking that's really thwarting their ability to break through? just these old age concepts, an old age concept that's just not serving them anymore.
The one that jumps out to me is the myth that raising debt is a sign of weakness and selling equity is a sign of success.
Oh, say that again.
All right, one more time. Here you go. Dramatic. Drum roll. All right. So here's the myth. Here's the myth. Raising debt is a sign of weakness and selling equity is a sign of success. That's the myth. So let me explain what I mean by that. I think it is a great credit to the geniuses of marketing that are venture capitalists who have led all of us to believe that selling equity is a sign of extraordinary success, that you've received the golden ticket, that you're bound to succeed. So you see this all over AngelList, people announcing, you know, $1 million equity rounds on AngelList and celebrating. And, you know, I think it should be like hashtag frowny face. I just lost a third of my company. Mm-hmm. I mean, general economics on equity sales for these kinds of companies is you're selling 18 to 25% of your business. And you see cases where companies later on become literally billion-dollar companies and founders own 50 basis points. It's really crazy. Meanwhile, when we talk to people about debt, it is really powerful to see the shame surrounding debt. I love Brené Brown's distinction. Guilt is that you did something wrong. Shame is that you are something wrong. And the embarrassment about it, the unwillingness to talk about it, people's nervousness about asking a family member to take on debt. Mm-hmm. For some reason, we've come to believe that it's better to ask someone for equity than it is for debt. And there are great cases where equity makes sense. Our company, Able itself, has no debt. We only have equity. It makes sense for certain kinds of companies, but the reality is for so many companies, a operating strategy should be, how can I lower my cost of capital? Meaning, how do I organize my capital sources, how the business is financed, to have effectively the lowest weighted average cost of capital, which just means keep your interest rates low and keep ownership of the business. So that's one that kind of weighs on me a lot. And it is such a powerful human force that, you know, I feel like we're playing with fire. But one that I'm just really curious about and hopeful that we can be a small part in helping people think rightly about how to keep ownership of most of their business and lower their cost of capital, which sounds like a wonky thing. It really just means, how can you grow your business and get it to profitability as fast as possible?
Wow. You know, I just love that. And again, it resonates with me because you asked me early on how I've really financed my companies.
Yeah.
And, you know, early on it was bootstrap sort of month to month, but as more successful I got and having more access to capital, everything's loans. So lines of credit.
Yeah.
Borrowing from one business or myself in order to pay startup the other.
Right.
But all of my financial capital has been through loans.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, well, and the equity things always scared me because I didn't want to give away all of my company.
Yeah.
And it was just scary. It seemed like just so much more. But at the same time, I felt like, man, maybe I'm not so cool because I've not really gone after the equity thing.
Yeah.
And I've got, you know.
Well, don't believe a word of it. You have done the right thing. And I might send some of our borrowers over to you to get the advice on it. It sounds like you were really scrappy and smart and doing it in a really strategic business sense way that was right for your business. And I just think there are these really deep things. And I don't know if it's, you know, most Americans do have massive credit card debts. Mm-hmm. And that's an area of shame. People who have gone through bankruptcies or defaulted on things, that's a big area of shame. I don't know if people are thinking about debtor's prison. I don't know where this stuff comes from. But clearly in your case, you were able to escape that and think of debt as a really successful and smart way to get growth. And that's awesome.
And there's difference between personal debt and business debt,
right,
which really is debt used to produce a return.
Yeah.
And, you know, for growth. So it's different than going into debt and buying things you can't afford to using money strategically in or as an investment and the using the money as a tool for to be paid off and to obviously leverage some sort of growth.
Well, next time these tables are going to turn and I'm going to be learning about how you use debt to grow your businesses because you have done it really well. And that's awesome.
Well, thank you. Well, it's been such a pleasure.
Hey, my
spending time with you.
Treat was all mine. I just yammered the whole time, which is a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Any final comments? Where do people find you? Like a lot of my audience, my base is they're small business owners. That's who they are. So how would they find you?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. So number one is our company, Able. We're all over social media. Our website's ablelending.com. And that will be a place to be able to connect with our team and work with one of our financial advisors to just help think about good options. Another thing I can throw out is I did write a book called Get Backed. And the website's just getbacked.com, which is about helping people put together pitch decks and run investor roadshows to raise capital. There's a chapter of Get Backed, which is on funding sources, which is available for download for free on the Get Backed website. And through either of those channels, if there's people who are trying to get funded right now and want to chat, I'd personally, you know, be eager to connect with anyone. I find great joy and energy getting out of bed in the morning, thinking that I can find a few entrepreneurs to find a little way to help them. So it's a real pleasure of mine.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Wow, what a fun conversation with Evan of Able Lending. We did that interview in their downtown Austin headquarters. They have an awesome warehouse space, tons of energy. It's a very fun culture. And so if you're ever in the area, be sure to drop by and say hello. I know they would love to see you. If you want to learn more about Able Lending, then please look to the show notes. We have everything linked up there for you. And you'll want to make sure to be around for our next episode where I continue this entrepreneurship conversation with my friend, this time, Eric Qualman. He is a master on online reputation. So we really talk about new tools and how to build your brand and really manage this online reputation that's so important in today's digital age. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to rate and review. That makes all the difference in the world, and I really appreciate it when you take an extra moment to review the episodes, as well as everyone that I interview. It's a great way to say thanks to them if you got any nuggets out of some of the learning or knowledge they shared. And as always, here's to living a wealthy, wealthy life. See you next time.